Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a real-world version of the Hunger Games coming to a country near you. Michael Clare, the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, joins us. We will discuss his article in the current issue of Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. Then we look into the fire at the Chevron oil refinery in Richmond, California, that is causing a sudden spike in gas prices on the West Coast. Roger Kim, the executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, who has been active in environmental issues with citizens in the community surrounding the refinery, joins us to discuss local anger at Chevron and why the refinery built in 1902 has had problems with fires following a 2007 fire that shut down the refinery for that year's first quarter. Then finally, we will speak with David Marples, the president of the North American Association for Belarusian Studies, about how Europe's last dictatorship has dealt with the attack of the teddy bears. Following a prank by a Swedish public relations firm that parachuted 800 teddy bears into a town in Belarus, the Swedish ambassador to Belarus has been expelled by the country's paranoid dictator, Lukashenko, who retaliated in a fit of fury, firing a slew of generals in charge of air defenses who failed to protect the motherland. And joining us now is Michael Clare, a Five College professor in Peace and World Security Studies and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article in the current issue of Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
Always a pleasure to join you.
And the idea that the movie, The Hunger Games, is actually going to come to a country near us is an alarming prospect. And not, of course, in your Mother Jones article, you point out that the United States is not quite that vulnerable. Food prices in the United States represent about 13% of the average household budget. But with the likely increases from the current droughts here in the United States, food prices will obviously go up and affect the people at the lower end of the economic scale. And which, given that the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, they alone control or have the equivalent wealth of 40% of Americans at the lower end of the income bracket. Leads you to understand that there are a lot of Americans out there who will be affected by the rising food prices.
Well, exactly right. 13% of our budget for wealthy people isn't going to be a terrible problem, but that's just an average. And there are a lot of unemployed people in this country. There are a lot of people living on just a few dollars a day, or, you know, maybe that's an exaggeration, but people, you know, living from day to day on what they have. And if prices of food go up, that's really going to hurt them, especially, you know, poor families with a lot of mouths to feed. This is going to be a real hardship.
So this is not the first time that we've experienced these spikes in food prices. And in many ways, the spike in food prices from 2007 to 2011 led to the Arab Spring. But let's go through some of the causes of these spikes. They vary. In part, there is, of course, the rising price of the cost of oil, which underlies a lot of the farming operations, particularly in the first world, with irrigation, food delivery, manufacture of pesticides and fertilizers. That is already contributed to the cost of food. And I understand that going to ethanol, as we have here in the United States, we've even increased the price of food in that regard. So walk us through these spikes, starting with the oil, and then we'll move on to the current manifestations of climate change.
Sure. Well, the first big spike occurred in 2008, and I'm sure your listeners are aware that that's when oil prices also went through the roof. And it's pretty clear that the rise in oil prices, when oil was selling for $140 a barrel and, you know, shot up in California for over $4 or $5 a gallon, that doubled the cost of oil for the production of food around the world. And as a result, the price of corn, rice, wheat, and many other staple products around the world doubled very swiftly. And this created immense pain and hardship for poor families around the world. There were riots and upheavals in two to three dozen countries, Cameroon, Egypt, Pakistan, and Haiti, especially in our part of the world. In Haiti, it became so severe that UN peacekeepers who were there for political reasons were called out to protect government facilities against rioting, desperate people clamoring for food. Five people died there. In Africa, scores were killed. So the rise of food prices is so has such a powerful effect on the lives of poor people in many parts of the world that it triggers political action right away. Now, that was largely caused in 2008 by the rising cost of fuel. The next big price spike in 2010 and 2011 was pretty much produced by global climate change. If you could remember the summer of 2010, it seemed like half of Russia was up in flames because it was so hot, and the wheat crop was destroyed there. There were also tremendous drought conditions in Argentina and Australia and China and parts of the United States. So once again, you had a huge increase in the price of wheat for making bread. And these prices started to roll over into the beginning of 2011 and started to affect North Africa, where in Egypt, Tunisia, where bread is the basic staple, at a time when disgust with corrupt and authoritarian governments was already at a feverish pitch. And the combination of rising food prices and the government indifference to the plight of the poor is what triggered the Arab Spring, first in Tunisia, then spread to Egypt, and of course to other parts of the Middle East. And I think now we're facing another, perhaps equally severe crisis, if not greater, because we're, again, global warming and high oil prices are going to combine now to push the price of food up around the world.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, who is the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College and the author of the recent book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article in the current issue of Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. So you talk about the Hunger Games, of course, an immensely successful young adult novel and a very successful movie. I think they're already making a sequel to it. How relevant is that kind of dystopian vision? How much is art imitating life here?
Well, I'll speak to that. First, I should say that my article appeared in Mother Jones Online, and the original article came from tomdispatch.com, if your listeners are interested in reading the article. But about Hunger Games, I found the movie very powerful, and I then turned to the book and discovered that the backdrop to the gladiatorial games that are portrayed in the movie are essentially what I'm talking about, global warming, heating up the planet, drought, and food scarcity in the United States, leading to a rebellion. The rebellion is crushed by the Capitol Panem, and the price that the rebels have to pay for their revolt is to sacrifice two teenagers each year for these televised gladiatorial games. Many of your listeners will be familiar with the story, but the backdrop is global warming, drought, and starvation. And I'm afraid we're going to see that, maybe not in this country, but in many parts of the world.
So how does this tie in then to your overall thesis, if you will, Michael Clare, in your new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources?
I think we're at a period today where all of the easily accessed, easily procured resources that we all depend on for survival and for industry, and I'm talking about water, food, land, oil, coal, copper, iron, and all of those things, has now been consumed, especially since World War II and the vast expansion of the global industrial base of modern civilization. So what's left now is very hard to obtain materials, hard to obtain resources, tough resources. I call it extreme energy, deep in underground, in the far north in the Arctic, deep offshore, fracking, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, which, by the way, requires a lot of water. So you're going to have a clash between the pursuit of the world's last resources and global warming clashing together, making for a desperate struggle, I fear, over what's left of the world's resources, unless we learn how to use resources in a much more frugal and prudent manner.
Well, that brings to mind, Michael Clare, what's going on in the tar sands of Alberta in Canada.
Exactly.
Because the apparently huge amounts of water required to bring the tar sands, take the tar out of the sands, the high pressure steam is used, and they use enormous amounts of water, which then go into these vast lakes, these brackish lakes. So at some point or other, I've talked to Canadian environmentalists, they say, you know, that the price of water is going to be equal to the price of oil, and the amount of water that's being used, you know, and being essentially destroyed as a resource is, at this point, but phenomenon. People that say if you fly over that area, it looks like the end of the world.
Exactly right. That's a very good example of what I'm saying. The easy resources are now gone, so we're pursuing things that nobody would bother with 25 years ago, like Canadian tar sands, because it's such a cruddy source of energy. But we're desperate for another fix of petroleum, and so we go after the tar sands or oil trapped in shale rock in this country. And to do that, you have to use extreme measures, environmentally dangerous and hazardous measures, and they all require a lot of water. And as you say, Ian, the water is not plentiful anymore and will be less so in the future, and we're going to have a struggle between those of us who want to eat every day and those who believe that fracking or tar sands production is more important. I think that's what it's coming down to.
So in other words, it's a choice between filling the gas tank or filling the stomach.
Yes, exactly.
So is there any, do you think that there's a growing awareness of what you're talking about? Because what was interesting about the Hunger Games, both the book and the movie, was that young people, teenagers, were drawn to it, even though it was deeply dystopian. So how do you explain that dystopian vision, yet the younger generation who are inheriting this world that we have screwed up for them, you know, are facing a bleak future?
You know, I think that young people are intensely aware of this bleak future they face, and there are those who say, well, we're just going to try to make the best of it and survive somehow, and those who more and more, I think, are going to become environmental activists. I certainly see that at my college, at Hampshire College in Massachusetts, where I teach, a growing number of students are becoming environmental activists as a result of what they see in the future. But I also understand young people who are so frightened by what they see that they go into denial, you know, and just engage in watching television and playing computer games. It's not hard to understand that.
Well, we are, of course, this year, 2012, this election year, we are witnessing one of the wealthiest families in this country, the Koch brothers. And I mentioned earlier how, just to give you an idea of the disparity in wealth in this country, that 40% of Americans at the lower end of the economic scale, their wealth is the equivalent to that of one family, the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart family. And then, so you have the Koch brothers who are in the oil business, who are pouring money into the political process to buy the next Congress and hopefully the next Senate for them and Mitt Romney. And they may well be successful. So how long do you think before there'd be a countervailing political movement if the oligarchs in their sort of last death throes of unbridled greed are grabbing the last of the resources? I mean, I don't notice people going to supermarkets and not buying brawny paper towels and Dixie cups that the Koch brothers make money off. They own those companies. So there are it's not like people are boycotting these products, even at this point, when the writing's on the wall.
You know, I think that the forces of nature are getting out of control, and this will have an effect on everybody's life. How that will play out in political sphere, I don't know. The New York Times is reporting tomorrow, I see, that July was the hottest month on record in U.S. history since they kept records, and the last 12 months was the hottest 12 months in U.S. history since they kept records. Much of the eastern and middle and southern U.S. have their hottest temperatures ever recorded, and it's creating terrible misery for many people, for farmers especially, in those parts of the country. And I think it's going to get harder to deny the reality of climate change in the years ahead as the effects become more powerful. So I do think that this will have an effect. And the price of food is going to rise, the price of fuel is going to rise, and this will make people more aware. How that will play itself out politically is very hard to say, but the awareness of the magnitude of the problem is certain to grow.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. He's the author of the new book, The Race for What's Left of the Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch and also at Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. But don't you think, Michael, that what this conversation's inevitably leading to in terms of, you know, I'm not talking about a utopian alternative to the dystopian Hunger Games future, but I'm suggesting that the inevitable alternative is to get off the corporate drug, whether it's corporate food, whether it's corporate energy, whether, you know, it's at some point or other, we all have to undergo a major social change, don't we, to free ourselves from these products that are destroying the planet and are destroying our health.
Well, I certainly think that what you say is true. Now, to what degree this will be a conscious political act and to what degree it will be forced upon us by the economy and by the climate is hard to say. You know, people aren't going to be able to afford to buy SUVs in the future. And so any business model based on SUVs or long drives out to the suburbs to the mall, that's not going to be possible anymore. So our lives will increasingly be dictated by economic and climate realities to adapt in new ways. And you know, corporations will either adapt to that or will perish in the end. And so to what degree we will make this a conscious decision to buy, you know, to scorn companies that fail to make wise, sustainable decisions, and to what extent this will be the product of the forces of nature, I can't say, but it will certainly happen. But I do think more and more people will choose to behave in a sustainable fashion and to protest those companies that persist in going in an unsustainable direction.
So do you think it'll be a case of choosing or will it be a case of necessity? If
It'll be both. It'll be both. And there'll be those people who will deny climate change and deny everything else, but they will be forced by necessity to adapt to a new world because a new world is coming.
Well, you know how much Al Gore has been lampooned, but in many ways he was the first to bring up this issue of global warming, at least in terms of the popular culture, with his film, An Inconvenient mm-hmm. Truth. And every day that passes, it's increasingly difficult to deny the obvious, even though there are these pernicious people like the Koch brothers and others who hire these academic whores to put out bogus studies saying climate change is a hoax. That, of course, slows down the extent to which we have that window of opportunity to deal with the problem itself. And I've talked to an awful lot of climate scientists to try and figure out, you know, how much the clock is ticking and whether or not we're running out of time. And one of the things that is so extraordinary about nature is that it's become self-reinforcing, the problem. As global warming increases, the climatic changes cause more and more methane to be released from the tundra, from as the ice melts, less light and heat is reflected back into outer space, and it's become self-reinforcing. And the more fresh water that is melted into the ocean, it slows down the currents and therefore affects the climates, and the whole, you know, planet becomes a kind of Sargasso Sea. So it's all, you know, it's all pretty clear. I hate getting involved in being the Cassandra, and I know, you know, this is not something that the audience enjoys listening to, but do you think we will reach a point soon where we won't have to deal with denial, but we'll have to deal with reality and deal with it very quickly?
You know, the way things change, Ian, is never, you know, you turn a switch from zero to one, you know, like they have on machines. Things change by more and more people moving in one direction and you reach a tipping point. And I do think that will occur. You'll see more and more people driving hybrids and more people abandoning the suburbs for the cities where they could use public transit. And right now it's not a majority. It's a minority of people who are more aware and more conscious. But that's going to gain momentum as conditions become more severe. And eventually it'll become, you know, a mass rush to abandon old ways of life and adapt to these new realities. It's like with smoking. You know, at first only a few people quit and everybody says, oh, I don't worry about that. But, you know, it reached a point where more and more people said we have to stop smoking. That's the way it's going to be. It will reach a tipping point. We're not there yet, but I think we will see it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Clare.
My pleasure, always.
I've just been speaking with Michael Clare, who is the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for the New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and his latest book is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article at Tom Dispatch and at Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the explosion at the oil refinery in Northern California that's already causing a spike in gas prices.
The sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, 'cause the way that